I'm Mike Brown, author, nerd, and host of the Dark Poutine podcast. Join me and Morgan Knudsen, author, paranormal researcher, and host of the TV shows Paranormal 911 and Haunted Hospitals, as we take you on a journey for the curious about the unseen, the mysterious, and the incredible things happening in the world about us. Welcome to Supernatural Circumstances. Science and the supernatural, not usually two terms you'll see together. Materialist scientists shout down claims of the supernatural as hogwash. These cries get louder if speaking of the field of medicine. There are definitely some crazy ideas out there, but we shouldn't ignore them all. That's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. First, in this episode, we'll hear from Morgan as she digs into some of the biases and beliefs of the scientific and medical fields and experiences that may help to change their mind. Later, we'll hear from paranormal researcher Christopher Alan Brewer. Christopher is one of the co-presenters with Morgan on the TV shows Haunted Hospitals and Paranormal 911. Christopher is a longtime writer and researcher. He's made several contributions to books, magazines, and other media, always coming from a place of honesty, vulnerability, and realism. A classic observer, his commentary on the human condition and all of its mysteries had made for some very engaging pieces, attracting thousands of readers worldwide. You can learn more about Christopher Alan Brewer on his website, thespiritchasers.com. Here's Morgan.
For the last four seasons, I have been privileged to be a host of the television show Haunted Hospitals. When I was first called on for this show, the deciding factor on whether or not I said yes was the premise. Over decades of teaching every person from every job and every walk of life imaginable, the one thing I noticed was that the medical profession held these stories very close to the vest. Doctors and nurses alike would attend my programs with other colleagues, all dying to tell their stories because they wouldn't dare speak of them at work. Why? Because the stigma in the medical community was similar to that in the military field. You may be seen as mentally unfit and possibly lose your reputation or maybe even your job. So I took the job on the show because I felt that this might be the opportunity to give a voice to many and offer my expertise as perhaps a third-party insight as to what might be happening, paranormal or not. One thing I've always noticed about these incredible experiences, and those who watch the show will notice it as well, the experiences are cross-cultural. This is not simply a Western phenomenon or an Eastern phenomenon. These experiences span the coastlines and mountains and forests of the globe. They don't care about oceans or vast miles of desert or even time. Every culture has a story, and often an explanation about what these occurrences are or were, and the passage of time often becomes indicative of the conclusions and vice versa. Interestingly enough, the older the culture, the more likely these things are dismissed as fairy tales or folklore. But as the fields of both parapsychology and cryptozoology progress, science is beginning to take a harder look at these cultural traditions, beliefs, and folklore, and apply them to both their own studies and to the medical field as well. Listening and understanding the traditions, cultures, beliefs, and experiences of each individual is becoming a lasting and valuable piece in the world of science and medicine, especially when patients are coming forward with stories which don't fit the often rigid worldview of materialism doctors often hold. Their world really gets shaken up when those professionals end up having an experience themselves. One vivid report which stuck with me was from my show Paranormal 911, when two paramedics responded to an elderly man calling 911 for help. His wife, he told the dispatcher, was having a heart attack. When the paramedics arrived, they saw the old man sitting in a chair downstairs, and he essentially ignored them other than pointing up to the second floor. They went up to the bedroom to find the old woman in full cardiac arrest, and when they inquired about her husband and why he was not upstairs with her, she managed to tell them her husband had recently died and his pamphlet from the memorial service was indeed on her dresser. The man in the photo was the man they had passed on the main floor, and meanwhile, A second group of responders also arrived, meeting the same old man on the front lawn who told them his wife was inside. Multiple witnesses, multiple age groups, including a call to the dispatcher, which was completely unexplained and an incredible ending for the woman who needed emergency care. These stories span the test of time, cultures, age, and no matter how many of these stories hit my desk, I'm struck with amazement and wonder at each one. The human explanation and interpretation might be different. A Christian may sum this up to the work of angels, while other cultures may see this as the returning spirit of a deceased elder, and others an omen of the woman's eventual death. Some people see anything to do with the paranormal as straight up evil, a belief I could never understand or relate to, but that is the interpretation of a select few. Either way, it is not necessary to believe in a specific belief system or the strict interpretation of it in order to understand, believe, and absorb these experiences. They are simply not strapped to one culture or belief system, and the interpretations in and of themselves may indeed hold clues to the answers we all ultimately seek, a greater understanding of who we really are.
So, Supernatural Circumstances, our anniversary show, Mike.
Is it? Oh my gosh, yes, Halloween.
Halloween. This is so nice. We debuted last October on the 25th of October, and yeah. it's been a whole year. So, Chris, you are our anniversary guest.
That is such an honor. Thank you so much.
Oh, we're so glad to have you. It's been like a long time coming too. Like, this is so silly because, I mean, we've been co-stars for four seasons.
It's so true. Well, I've only met like Richard like one time too.
Same. Yeah, people think that we all like meet each other. We don't.
Like, yeah, we don't. Beatles. Yeah, like Help. They all live in the same house.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, it's the funniest thing. And everybody thinks, we're all like, you know, filming together and whatever. And it's like, I see no one except for Tobin. Tobin
and
Kate.
How often do you see Tobin?
When we shoot.
Yeah.
That's it. Oh my gosh. So anyway, that being said, we're so, so glad that you're here. And there's so much that I've wanted to ask you over the years. And, one of the big things is, you know, when we've talked kind of on the side about your upbringing and some of the things that you went through when you were younger, was the paranormal something that was celebrated in your family?
It was. I mean, from the very beginning, it's almost like our bedtime stories were 100% real, you know, like from spirits to Sasquatch, star people, you know, the cryptozoological, you know, everyone in our tribe knew someone who had shared these experiences. And then if not, it was just a matter of time until you experienced that yourself. So that was just really a part of like our DNA. You know, my uncle was a reservation cop, and, you know, he was the first to report to the scene of any accident. So he had a number of different encounters, not just with spirits, but again, like Sasquatch, like what we called star people. So he would tell me these stories. You know, I'd hear stories coming down the pike from, you know, some cousins who had just been to maybe like a Sundance or something, and things that had happened there. So lots of different stories in that realm. It's just, they were 100% real, and we never doubted anybody. You know, we knew these were 100% factual, and that was just part of our reality in that tribe.
Oh, I'm so excited by this because you just touched on like 10 subjects that I love. So I'm like, which way do I go? This is so cool. Well, cause you know, cause you're Sue, right?
Yes. Yogala Sue. Yes.
Yeah. And you know, you bring such a great perspective to everything that we do with haunted hospitals. What was the, it's true. You know, what was the first encounter that you had personally, and what do you remember about it?
Probably my first encounter was, we would hear, we had our own cryptozoological kind of creatures. So ours was we don't know what it was, but we had this bad flood once on the reservation, and we had this place called Dinosaur Hill, which is still out there. But it's like this park, and they have these giant dinosaurs like in, Pee-wee's Big Adventure,
yeah.
Like the big dinosaurs. Whatever it was, it came from that area. And I know there was like a lot of death. There was like a massacre around there like at one time. So they were sacred grounds. You know, some ceremonies had been done in the area. So I don't know what this was, but we would hear it at night, sometimes walking past. There were things that made noises like metallic noises, buzzing noises. You know, you think, you know, this call of the Wendigo or these other creatures, but sometimes what we heard was almost like electronic. You know, we couldn't really, there were very high pitched sounds. My first experience wasn't until we actually really moved off of the reservation. I was maybe five, and it was the first house we lived in the outskirts of downtown Denver. And it was a turn of the century house. The previous tenant had hung herself. And for some strange reason, my mother put me in that room.
Oh, boy.
So my father worked a night shift. It was just me and my mom. And a lot of nights you could, it didn't even have the door, this closet where she hung herself. It was like this heavy, almost like a curtain, like a fabric curtain. And I don't remember this. She said sometimes you could see her her feet swinging from underneath the curtain. But you could hear her crying. And I just remember that hearing that woman cry before I went to bed sometimes. And just that sorrow was just like so heartbreaking, because we're raised with the beliefs that our ancestors are always around. And, you know, for the most part, it's a very benevolent type of interaction you have with these spirits. But, you know, once we got off the reservation, that's when I was super hypersensitive to other spirits, which weren't so nice, you know, which maybe remained in states of like sadness or anger. So that's something that really took me a while to figure out, and how some could be harmful. One of the reasons we moved out of that house was because there was this really heavy cellar door in the basement. And I heard that woman down there again. So I went to peek. I thought my mom was down there. And I had my hands hanging over the lip of the door, and this cellar door just shut by itself and tore open one of my fingers, left a huge scar, which kind of symbolically branded me with that interest in how spirits could affect the living in that manner. So,
did your family practice any sort of like cleansing rituals around things like this?
You learned that from the start. I mean, one of the first things you learned was you don't go seeking these spirits. You know, if they had a message for you, they would appear to you most likely in your dream time, because, you know, in our tribe, we believe that the astral world and the world of spirit lie very close together. So it was really easy for those spirits to impart knowledge to us in our dream time. So when we, to this day, when we have visitations in our dream time, if I dream of my mother or my father, it's, you know, I'll call my sister. Did you have this visitation too? Yes, she did. So they kind of make the rounds that way. But I'm sorry, what was your question?
Oh, it was just about cleansing rituals at that house in particular.
So obviously sage, cedar was more for like the more powerful spirits. That, you know, there's different things you could do to like invite them like unknowingly, but a lot of times it was the sage, the cedar, the sweetgrass to bring like positive elements. And that was just pretty much to like neutralize like any energy that had built up. And that wasn't just spirits, it was for sickness. Maybe you had like an argument with, you know, your lover, anything that puts you in like maybe like a state of fight, you know, you'd want to smudge after that. And another big thing was kind of like putting a plate of food outside your home to draw the spirit out. I had an aunt once who was involved in this, you know, tragic car crash. And they had a really hard time getting her to leave because, you know, she'd wake up like at 2 a.m. I don't know if that's for her job or what it was, but every night at 2 after her death, you know, that radio would come on and her light would come on. And she had the ability to confuse people. So if they left the house, when they were trying to find their way back, they'd get lost. Sometimes they'd come back to the house, only her light, you know, and the house would be on, which they knew, they turned off all the lights before they left. But she was, we finally ended up having to burn her clothes. That was the only way to stop those hauntings. So, you know, you think of these really friendly, benevolent spirits, but that wasn't always so. Like when my grandmother left, one of the things she liked to do when she was alive was to go through people's like wedding presents and stuff. So, you know, after she passed, you know, that was still the thing. Like someone was getting married, you know, you'd see the doorknobs turning, which everyone's like, oh, that's just old grandma. But, you know, as children, we were kind of like horrified. It's like, well, what are we going to see if we open up that door?
Right? Yeah.
So, yeah. But we learned very early how to use sage and, you know, different elements to smudge, different meditations and visualizations.
That's so neat, because meditation and, you know, all of that. I love how how so much of your culture, one of my dear friends and colleagues, she is Cree. And I love how so many of these traditions are just so applicable to so much, you know, that meditation, that centering of yourself, you know, it's such a beautiful thing, you know, that these different First Nations cultures are so in touch with that. And it's something that is so special. And I think we're missing that in today's society.
I don't know what I'd do without that. Like, you know, the very first meditations I ever had were, you know, maybe if I was having a trouble with like an algebra problem, my grandfather would instruct me to go and talk to this grandfather rock. Sounds ridiculous. To put your ear to it, to listen to it. What does the rock look like? Does it look like an old man? Can you hear the wind? Just all these things, these different exercises to connect yourself with natural elements. And it wasn't just like, you know, for instance, a lot of people think of animal totems coming to impart them with their powers. It was also the elements. I'm really, I gravitate more towards like water. So if I'm really having a hard time trying to reset, like a really good Epsom salt bath really helps me out. But just having that connection to nature, like a lot of people getting their hands on the earth, like, you know, gardening and things like that. But I don't know if they think so much about what that element is or even thank that element, you know, like afterwards. So we are really do have like a deep connection to the natural world.
It's so special. And I mean, but Mike and I, we've been such big proponents of meditation and stuff from the beginning. I mean, it's something that's really important to both of us too. And then of course, for me, it's fire performing. You know, I find it's like a zen, you know, to just be with the fire, and it just centers you in such an incredible way. But I know, Mike, like you've been meditating for years.
Yeah, I started practicing meditation when I sobered up. It was part of my... Part of getting sober was a spiritual practice for me, and meditation is part of it. And I have found over the years, I was not open to this stuff at all when I first began meditating. But as I have over the years, I feel like I've come in touch with, I think the philosopher writer Colin Wilson calls it Faculty X, which is this kind of, there's something underneath it all that... only certain practices will help you to connect to, and that's kind of the way it works for me, is through meditation.
Mm-hmm. When you first got the call, Chris, for haunted hospitals, I'm guessing Tobin probably phoned you. What were you thinking?
I think I was just really happy to be able to provide like some like native representation, because working where I do, like in a metaphysical shop, you know, we get the customers who it's like, you know, I just moved into this old house, I'm having issues. Or maybe they saw something on like one of the paranormal shows, which maybe they were misinformed about something, so they want advice about something. Or maybe their children are seeing things, you know, they don't. So again, what was your question? I'm going down so many different routes.
It's totally okay. No, you're on all the right routes. It's all good. But when you first got the call, I mean, what went through your head with haunted hospitals? Like that you were going to be able to offer something?
I guess my first thought was I just didn't want to bring any shame to my tribe or my family. First of all, I wanted to word everything correctly, make everything factual, because a lot of our culture, you know, for some people is a novelty, you know, it's, you know, you have these kind of DNA tests, these ancestry tests. And I've known so many people that were so upset that they weren't Native American. It was almost like a Pokemon. They didn't get the Native American egg or something like that. But it's just, you know, these are all things that we, you know, we all have a connection to the earth, to elements, to like animals, things that we don't really think about. Like our dream time is so huge to us. You know, that's where we get all of our visions, you know, all of these things. And, you know, a lot of people just look at it as like a random neural firing or download of the day without any really pertinent messages. And I remember early, like when I got my first A, my report card, my grandfather would share things with me. And one of the first things was how you know, we do believe in these dream spirits that come and to impart knowledge. But they speak a different language, which is like a symbolic language. So we always had them on hand to kind of help us decipher what was going on. But it was more about like how we felt, you know, how did you feel after this dream? So again, putting us in touch with our inner feelings, you know, from very, very early, and that kind of trust and faith in our intuition.
So you say you talk to your grandfather a lot. Do you still utilize elders in your tribe to sort of check yourself and make sure you're on the right track?
Well, it was really strange because about 4 years, my father passed on Day of the Dead. My grandfather left like a month after him. That's who I got my Indian name for, Sydney Bird. And then about 2 years ago, my mom left. So part of my writing my book was to kind of preserve like a lot of this knowledge and a lot of these stories. There are still people, you know, that's just harder to find because since COVID, a lot of them are still under like lockdown. Mm-hmm. You know, they can't lose their language. You know, they can't lose a lot of this knowledge. So they're being really, really careful. So ceremonies, like this year, they had the first powwow they've had in Denver since this, you know, pandemic began, which was wonderful. But again, you know, we didn't see like a lot of elders there. So that's part of this book is just writing it all out. But there are still some people I can go to if I need advice. But, you know, I'm like 49 years old, so I've gleaned a lot of knowledge since then.
Right. Yeah, you're kind of one of the elders now.
Yeah, I guess so.
How do you feel about First Nations being represented within the paranormal? Do you think it's underrepresented? Because I kind of feel like it's underrepresented.
You know, I'll like see some groups here and there. I'll see some things on YouTube or TikTok, which is really good as long as it's not too sensational. I kind of feel like as a Native American, I'm just kind of given this free pass. And, you know, sometimes like, you know, this is what we believe. This is what's real. You know, different tribes have different beliefs. So I don't speak on behalf of like every tribe.
Sure.
But it is something I do feel is underrepresented, which is really strange because, you know, just for instance, like we didn't really share a lot of this stuff until Poltergeist came out like in 1982. Mm-hmm. That was when it kind of like opened up this dialogue with other families who are having similar experience. You know, you don't want to talk about these things really because, you know, a lot of people don't have these beliefs. I grew up and it was just strange as a child that topics like, you know, ghosts or Bigfoot or UFOs were just kind of like ridiculed when that was just our realm. You know, it made no sense to us. But it really wasn't until that movie till we could really start to talk to other families about what we were experiencing in our own homes. And for us, it wasn't anything like negative. It was just part of coexisting with different life forms. You know, we believe much of what we coexist with was unseen anyway. So,
yeah, that makes sense. You know, as we go along with these shows, and I think people, or what I'm seeing at least within TV and film and stuff like that, is that some of these stories, and especially within the cryptozoological world, is really starting to shed light on a lot of encounters that people are having. Like, you know, here in Alberta and then in the Midwest, you know, we talk a lot on the show about things like Dogman. And it's so fascinating because, you know, as I was saying, my best friend is Cree, and you know, it's something that she's been able to draw quite a bit on her own understanding and culture, and then had a learning curve on top of that. But you know, with things like this, and I think it's really cool that I think at least on some level, you know, we're starting to turn back to the Indigenous people to go, okay, we don't have an explanation for this, help. And yes. I think it's a good position to be in, honestly. It makes us listen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just surprised by how many people come into the store and they don't have any background, you know, so they don't know how to deal with these children that are seeing things that aren't there. Or, you know, a lot of times it's like the husbands that come in. It's like, my wife is going through this thing. She doesn't know what it is. She's kind of turning to these shows, which, you know, a lot of them are like kind of fear-based programs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So I have to be very responsible, obviously, with everything I share.
Well, that's one of the things I love about what you and myself and Richard do, and what the producers on Haunted Hospitals accomplish, is that, you know, the audience still gets a thrill factor when they watch the show. But
yes.
I feel like all three of us come from that same perspective where we're trying to keep everybody's feet on the ground, you know, in whatever way. And you bring, you know, the First Nations experience to it. I try to bring the parapsychological. And then, of course, Richard brings the medical. And that makes me really proud that we're able to do that. You know, everybody might not agree with us, but, you know, I feel like we kind of keep things as grounded as we possibly can.
Yeah. And, you know, like on the show, you know, like a lot of people recognize me from the shows in the store and come in for advice. And it's, you know, my first thing is always, you know, you really have to take responsibility for your life experience.
Absolutely.
That's another teaching that started like really early. You're always going to have visitations or sightings of things that you can't explain. That's just part of that unknown world and coexisting with other life forms. But, you know, there's a lot of times there's elements of fear attached to it. And a lot of that's just, you know, fear of the, you know, fear of what you don't understand, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Have there been stories on the show so far that have stuck with you? Has there been anything that has stood out that you remember?
Probably, especially like Paranormal 911. There was a story where a woman had been driving a motorcycle with her brother and she slid out under a truck and was killed. And the first responder saw her. She thought she was still alive. She came to her and she told this first responder not to let her brother see her. So she's like, okay. And then, you know, later she saw the dead body and she understood what that was. She covered up her body so the brother wouldn't see her. But again, I think because my uncle, you know, would tell me about a lot of these accidents and different things that he would see, you know, like one of them, this family had gone out during Christmas to be with other parts of their tribe, and they had got lost in the snow. And they didn't, you know, obviously there wasn't cell phones back then at that time, but they got snowed in and they all froze to death. So it was a mother, father, and their baby. And it was a while before they could go looking because the snows out there were really, really bad. So my uncle was one of the ones that went out there looking for them. So he pulled over and he was hearing a baby crying. So he followed it to the spot and this whole tree just like lit up, just like all of this light. And that's where they dug and that's where they found the bodies. Wow. But, you know, we'd hear about this area in Pine Ridge where you could go. It was this curve where they had slid off. And we do some nights on the anniversary, it sounds like urban legend, but it was actually, I know so many people that did this, that drove past there and that tree like lit up again, you know, it was still lighting up, even though they were no longer in any danger. So it's just, you know, these are all things that we took really, really seriously.
Yeah. Well, I mean, through all the year here that Mike and I have been doing this show, I mean, that's the one thing that I think Mike, you might agree with this, is that predominantly and with haunted hospitals as well, I know the thing that I've really taken home from it is, you know, no matter what anybody's take is on the story, is that we are not alone. We are not alone. Yeah. You know, there is so much more, whether you call it consciousness, whether you call it, you know, angels, whether you call it, you know, whatever it is, it's, you know, your word for it. We are not alone. Mike, what do you think about that?
Oh yeah. I mean, I see here in your notes, you're asking about, have you ever had a hospital encounter yourself? And one of those that I had was when I was working at Vancouver Hospital. I was a security guard at the large Vancouver Hospital. And this encounter didn't happen to me directly, but we had all known about this guy who's apparently, it might have been talked about on your show, but a ghost that would haunt the tunnels underneath what used to be the burn unit in Vancouver Hospital. And he was apparently a lumberjack, so he was dressed in that kind of clothing when he received his burns and those kind of things. And he passed away from those burns in the hospital. One night, you know, we'd all made jokes about this ghost and that kind of thing. One night, one young guy who had just started there, and I'm not sure if he even knew about these stories. At lunchtime, he was already sitting in the guard shack, and he was shaking. He was white as a sheet, and we asked him, you know, what's going on? And he said, well, I was down near Heather Pavilion, where this old burn unit used to be, and walking along and saw this guy dressed like he was a woodcutter, but, you know, it looked like his clothing was really old, like an older timey clothing. And he said he started to walk toward this guy and the guy didn't acknowledge him, but walked essentially right through him. And when he turned to look, the guy had disappeared. He wasn't there anymore. So he came into the guard shack and was sitting there. He wouldn't eat his lunch, and he just said to the site supervisor when he came, he just said, "I have to go." And the site super was like, "Well, you know, you've only been here half a shift," and he just said, "After what I saw, I'm not going to work here anymore." And he left. We never saw him. We never saw him again. He was just terrified. And from what I learned about the guy, he wasn't the type of guy who would have just made something like that up, you know? And I did have little experiences with lights coming on and all that kind of stuff in the old nurse's residence there, which everybody claimed was haunted. But I didn't ever see anything like that. Have you ever had any like real visual experiences like that?
I've seen a lot of different things. We used to do this presentation at Evergreen Cemetery here in Colorado Springs every year in this chapel. And the basement of this chapel was an old mortuary. So a lot of times when we'd go down there, we'd be the first to kind of like set up and turn on lights. And you'd see these things that were like, they almost look like fireflies. And then we had I had been interviewed by a guy from Fox 31 News that came down with a professional photographer. And they were taking pictures down there, and they were getting these like fluorescent rods, which I had seen earlier, but I didn't say anything to anyone because I didn't want to influence any of this. But he was getting these things on film, and they didn't know what they were. But I think the first thing I ever saw was this. I had just woken up from my dream time, and I saw these blue symbols appearing in front of my closet. I don't know. I still don't know what those were to this day. And I know those weren't like dream residue, but it wasn't a spirit. It was, I don't know what it was or why I was shown that. Maybe just something that just kind of sits in my subconscious till I'm ready to process it. But probably the first thing visually I ever saw.
Sorry to interrupt, but have you ever tried to recreate the symbols that you saw, like draw them out or anything like that?
Oh yeah. When I got my Indian name, my grandfather gave me a dream journal. So I wrote in it till I filled it up. And then every morning I wake up, I write down my dream and then I on my phone, and then I just email it to myself. So that's full of symbols, you know, dream visions, things I've had over the years, which I don't really share with anyone, but
sure.
That's so exciting to me to hear that, actually, because one of the fellows that I work with here in Edmonton, that's how he receives things as well. It's in symbols and images, and sometimes they don't even at the moment make sense. But later on, we find pieces of the case or the puzzle, and it's blatant what the symbols are. The one that I can think of right off the top of my head is when he was just a child at the time, and he was seeing these eggs and these images of these eggs, almost like a Easter egg almost type thing, all in different colors, and he couldn't figure out what in the heck they were. And it was during this very strange time in his life where there was an entity that was just bothering him and the family. And lo and behold, the case had ties to a lake not far from here called Egg Lake. And
oh my gosh.
Yeah. And we didn't like no clue. I mean, at the time it was just like, I'm just seeing these eggs. I don't know what this means. I don't know what this is. And lo and behold, it has to do with Egg Lake. So he was getting these as well. So that it makes me excited to hear you say that.
Well,
I mean, a lot of them have been very kind of premonitory, you know, also. So I always kind of go back and, you know, reread these after a while.
Yeah, I know for myself, and I mean, I'm definitely, I wouldn't consider myself a medium by any stretch, but I definitely am learning to hone that intuitiveness. And I always find that if I am getting any kind of messages or anything like that, I tend to get them in either ciphers or sometimes symbols, but it's like the universe will deliver me the same symbol over and over and over again until I acknowledge it. I get that quite a bit, which is kind of interesting. And I have fun, like, tracing what it is I'm looking at until I figure it out. It's so cool. And it just provides such a wonderful interconnection to that consciousness. Do you find that too?
It's so sad because it is such a frontier. And, you know, a lot of my friends and people that come into the store, they don't really remember their dreams, but it's something you can train yourself to do, you know, over time. So I'm always talking about this, you know, and just a lot of, when I got my Indian name, you know, like the very first dream I had that night was I was being driven down like this desert. And I think the desert kind of symbolized where I felt like in my life, everything was kind of dried up. I didn't have any prospects. I couldn't see the driver because of this glint of the rearview mirror. And we were coming up on the sign, like the Hollywood sign with these big giant letters. I turned around to see what the sign read, and it said, God exists. And then that's when I caught a glance of the driver, who was, I realized it wasn't a reflection of light. He was made of light. That was my creator. So ever since then, it's just, and it wasn't just, some of them were like really comical dreams. Again, just developing a deeper relationship with, a more intimate relationship with creator. So a lot of these were designed to kind of introduce wonder and playfulness. It wasn't all about these visions. And, you know, like in my family, there's a lot of runners because, you know, Billy Mills, like the first Native American to win like a Olympic medal. And we were all, you know, we had to be these runners and do these big things for representation. It wasn't always about that. You know, it was just about, you know, we believe that the dream time, this place you go to is a very real place. For me, it was this dream lodge. So where other people might think of like maybe like a memory palace, somewhere they can like visit. We believe like in this dream lodge, which was an actual like astral structure where you could go to receive instruction.
That is so cool and fascinating. And, you know, with all of this, I mean, you and I, we've done so much paranormal TV. It's crazy. Considering what we've been talking about, this idea of that a connection. And I think that's what we all aim to promote, is this idea of, you know, that this is an inner journey and that, you know, the paranormal can teach us so much. What is your overall take on the influence of a lot of these paranormal TV shows on the public view of this? Because it's real. In my experience with this, I think oftentimes these, you know, especially the ghost hunter type shows have really skewed the public perception, I think, on the bigger picture of the paranormal.
Yeah. Well, you know, like for instance, in the store, a lot of people that come in and see these shows, you know, there's a lot of people that like past like 4 or 5 years have been really opening up to their like empathic abilities. You know, they see these shows, you know, what's it like to be a medium? I think I have some of this in my background. So they're really opening up to like these skills and abilities, like their intuition, you know, people that have never really listened to that inner voice. And a lot of times it's just something that scares them, you know, but they'll regret it later. It's, you know, if they get an impulse to turn left and they don't take it, you know, it's just that trust they have to develop over time. But I think these, I mean, you've seen everything there is to see, I think, for a lot of these. So it's really like a lot of the research and information. You know, I tune into a lot of things, but, you know, I'm still kind of like stuck in the 80s. So a lot of times I'll be watching like Arthur C. Clarke, sightings, like In Search Of was like a big one when I was growing up.
Yeah, that was great.
One of the things I'll always appreciate about my father watching these shows was, you know, once it ended, you know, I'd ask him, you know, is this real? Do you believe this real? And, you know, he never took away my wonder, just said it's like swamp gas or it's a hoax or any of these things. He just kind of granted me that wonder, the ability to keep that. And I think that's missing with a lot of people that watch these shows. Maybe they're so jaded or desensitized, you know, whatever it is. So,
you've hit so much on so much. I love everything you're saying, because I think you're so spot on with that. And you're right. It's that sense of wonder. And that, you know, recently I was talking with Terry Lynn, because we've been doing these workshops out at her acreage called the Haunted Hollow. And that was the one thing that, you know, we try to impart on people every single time, because she's got, they have this incredible property that is just a plethora of incredible activity. And every time we take a group out, stuff goes on. And as soon as we get back to the house and we're debriefing everybody, that's the one thing we're always saying, is that this is about bringing back a sense of magic that people have lost. They've lost that.
Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. It's so true. Like one of the first we did way back like in 2012, it wasn't anything Tobin, or it wasn't one of those shows. It was a different, I'm not going to name it, but we went and explored this place and we were just fascinated. We were so fascinated that we were getting audible communication.
Oh, cool.
That we were getting pictures of these things, just really tapping into all of these legends and, you know, the earth, you know, we were underground. But, you know, obviously when the producers got a hold of it, well, it's, you know, let's say you heard these screams and this happened that happened. And it was just so sad that it turned into more of like a fear-based thing when we couldn't have been happier. And we go back to that site like often, but it's just one of those things, you know, it's just, we were in such a state of wonder. And I think that allowed, because for us, again, one of the early teachings we were given was don't, you know, you want to tap into your own intuition, your own inner voice. And if you have a fear, you want to make sure that that's your fear. It's not the fear of the world around you or someone trying to make you scared of something they're afraid of, you know, so because that fear was like a contaminant and it would instantly like alter whatever your reality was.
Absolutely.
So just that separation of that and again, allowing wonder and excitement into that experience.
Yeah. The one thing I'm always telling people that you know, approach me with stuff like this is to exchange fear with curiosity. And I think when people are able to do that just in general in their life, then it makes a massive difference. Like if you, you know, even just on a cultural example, you know, if you've got a new culture, say for example, that is, you know, a family's moving in, new culture, new neighbors, if you approach that with curiosity instead of fear, you'd have a lot better world going on. And if the paranormal is so similar to that, it's like, but we've lost that because there's this, you know, this sense of, you know, if I don't understand it, then it's out to get me. And it's crazy to me, just crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I think fear can be a good thing because it can heighten senses.
Absolutely.
And, you know, get the energy and a location up. Like the last two investigations we did, it was this former hospital in Florence. And we did this thing where, it seems like every investigation, you know, someone pulls out like the spirit box and it's just, that's all they do, you know, for the rest of the night. So I designed this game called I Dare You, which wasn't like a sensational game. It was more like, you know, everyone is given these like random tasks to do alone. So we'd send them down to the basement. They would open up a bag. It would have instructions in there and tools. So there might be like a pod or dowsing rods, maybe like a pendulum, more like old school things.
Yeah.
Designed to help them like interact with the environment and also explore their own fear and see how much of that was just what would happen, you know, like these experience with like tulpas and these ghosts, you know, kind of people created almost like the, what is that? The ghosts of Gay Street.
Mm-hmm.
It's the gentleman who wrote like a lot of the shadow stories,
yes,
who was influenced by Batman. And obviously when he died, you know, they were seeing a spirit in his old apartment, but it wasn't him. It was the shadow, you know, this being that he created.
Yep.
So, but that was a really interesting thing to do, to be able to tap into an environment and just kind of like explore where you're at with your fear. Like one of my dares was this old monastery we went to. And my dare was to go into the basement alone. I had to lay on this gurney where people had died being transported to the ambulance. And I had to lay there and, you know, I had to use like an EMF detector and like take pictures. And that was probably one of the most scariest things I've ever did. But it really put me in a state where I had to just kind of like siphon out my fear, be present. It really makes you be present in that present moment, really grounds you to that location. And then also brings like a lot of empathy forth too, for the people that had died, you know, in that area. So, and a lot of this, what I try to do is really try to, get that empathy out of people. A lot of people just, you know, on these, I don't want to say a lot of people, but sometimes there's some misinformation with some of these shows when they go on these investigations and, you know, maybe running screaming or, you know, they call out to something. And then when they get activity, they kind of freak out and leave.
Yeah.
Or, so, you know, we're more tapped into like the history and the people, because there's so many stories, you know, at this hospital we went to, we could tell there was definitely a lot of stories that needed to be communicated.
Absolutely. And that's, you touched on a couple of things there that I'm huge on as well, which is the fact that so much of our focus and our intention creates what we're experiencing. And, you know, I think you're spot on, especially with, you know, the idea that, you know, people's focus and their ideas and their perceptions create their reality. And you, especially walking into some of these places, you know, you really do get where you're resonating. And Mike, I mean, you and I, we've talked about this concept for ages, mm-hmm. that, you know, we walk into a place and, you know, what you're projecting or your focus, like in the Philip experiment in Toronto, you know, can actually create consciousness. And it's incredible, but it happens, and we've seen it.
Yeah. Having worked in the movie business and in security, I always had access to places that not everybody had, like the Riverview Hospital for the mental hospital here. Mm-hmm. I've been all through that. And there are certain places in that hospital where you can feel there is something there. There, like you say, there are stories that need telling. I'm not quite as adept, I think, at connecting to those, but I can feel that they're there. I just wish that we could do some investigations around some of the places that I've been, because I've, like I say, I've had access to really cool things.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. Sorry, Chris, go ahead.
Oh, you're fine. Just as far as like this communication, you know, it's, I used to live near this park where a 737 went down in like 1991, killed everyone on board. And I just kind of had this curiosity about what happened at night, because I knew a woman that used to jog through there, and she used to feel that sometimes there were people running past her that she couldn't see. Mm. And obviously as a native, you know, we cleanse these places. We do what we can to bring, you know, peace to these spirits. So we would go and, you know, a lot of, you know, they turned it into this story has been on like paranormal, different paranormal programs. But the deal was they thought the plane had gone down due to like a wind shear. And yet this happened again to another plane in Virginia, where 125 people were killed. Happened a third time. By that time, they decided that they knew it was like a faulty rudder. So I think the spirits in that park, there were hauntings occurring because they were trying to let people know, I think, that it wasn't a wind shear, that it was a faulty rudder that would go on to cause these other accidents. Mm-hmm. So when we started getting flashing lights, voices, you know, we weren't running, we were staying there because obviously someone was trying to convey something to us. And a lot of people, it's like picking up that phone. It's like once you hear something, a lot of people just run off or hang up that phone.
Yeah.
You know, they're not getting the message.
Yeah. And that's a thing, you know, like I remember when I investigated a hospital here in Edmonton, and it's abandoned now. But back in the day, it was being used for a lot of films and stuff like that. And it has a very rocky, nasty history behind it. And when we were allowed in, I remember experiencing stuff in there that I've never experienced before or since. And one of those instances, we were up on the sixth floor, but it was the psychiatric ward. And there'd been a lot of stuff go on there. There'd been a suicide. There'd been a whole bunch of things, and just the patients were treated horrifically. And Stephanie and I, we were actually in some of the isolation rooms that were just off of the main hall, and the rest of our team at the time were on other floors. We had them, and we had security cameras on each floor, watching each floor. And out of nowhere, nobody else on this floor, there's no power to the building, we hear this scream, and it was right in between the two of us. Nobody else there. It was unbelievable. And we caught it on our video camera. We caught it on our audio recorders, everything. And the two of us looked at each other. And at first we thought it had come through the walkie-talkie. And so immediately radioed down, and we were like, you know, is everybody okay? You know, and they were talking to us like we were nuts. They're like, well, yeah, you know, the hell's your problem?
Yeah.
And lo and behold, it had happened right in the middle of the space, and we caught it all on video. But it was absolutely amazing. And I just remember the energy within that area. As soon as we had walked in, it was like we'd hit a wall. And it's unmistakable. It was, and I mean, the scream was residual energy, but it was, something I will never forget. Definitely one of the highlight moments of the job, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely a lot of residual energy here. You know, I'm really drawn to places which, you know, are near like a lot of parks, like natural structures. We have this place called Garden of the Gods here, where there's a lot of kind of elemental, you know, even like fairy energy, if you want to call it that. But a lot of Gold Rush ghosts, you know, a lot of, you know, we live at the base of Pike's Peak, which a lot of people came down here to make their riches in gold and silver. And a lot of people, you know, Pike's Peak or bust, well, they just went bust.
Right.
Or a lot of people that came up here with a fresh mountain air to help cure their tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. So a lot of former places where a lot of people that died from tuberculosis, a lot of echoes, you know, a lot of people assume it's, you know, a lot of times they're intelligent spirits. And obviously a lot of times it's just that that residue, you know.
So let's get into your book a bit, because I mean, I was so happy when you announced that you were writing Selfies of the Underworld, because it needed, you needed to write something. It was just, it was so important. What inspired the title? Because Selfies of the Underworld, I've never heard that. That is just cool.
It's a great title.
What inspired that one?
I think it's just, you know, selfies is such a big deal. It's like, what can I name in this book that's going to stand out, that people are going to be able to relate to, modern day people, because it's a book that takes you back and back and back. So, but also I thought of just, you know, all the events we go to every year, where we're kind of literally taking selfies, you know, like this, this place we investigated, it was this cave where we were first getting a lot of these forms. It was a place where the Indians of the time believed an entrance to the underworld lied. So, and there's a lot of associations with different cultures, with caves and the underworld. They always link those two.
Sure.
But this place was, you know, I knew a Diné man that said, no, there really is a portal down there that you have to go investigate. So we went down there, and sure enough, you know, I don't know if it was Ute spirits or what it was we were making contact with, but some of them were like selfies from the underworld. So I was like, I've got to put that in the title.
it's brilliant. Like, it's really good. If people are just picking up this book for the first time, why, in your opinion, is this book different than the other books of tales and encounters that people can pick up?
I think because it's a real person that's lived these experiences, but someone that's also struggling to figure out their path. Why, you know, for instance, I, you know, these things are drawn to me, you know, why some spirits remain, why some spirits are at peace. There's just so many elements that go beyond just paranormal. There's, you know, there's our dream time, there's native wisdom, there's different exercises in there, but it's just a story, you know, from the first memories I can remember to when I got my Indian name, and then all the experiences are wrapping back up again. So, yeah.
I think that's the one thing, Mike, that you and I have found throughout doing this entire show and having talked to so many guests, is that this is literally why I wrote The Gift of Instinct, was that there were so many people that, and everybody had said, there was a calling, there was a deeper purpose. You know, I dropped what I was doing so I could pursue this, because I knew it with every fiber of my being that this was calling me to something more. And that, if I'm interpreting you right, Chris, that this is, that was your story as well.
It is. And a lot of it just to, I mean, I'm still learning, obviously, and still evolving and trying to make sense of a lot of these things. I mean, you know, as an investigator, you know, you go through hours and hours of data, video, audio, all of these things. But, you know, for me, these things bleed through on different levels. You know, my dream time, you know, once we had visited this old mining town, and I was really drawn to this particular room of this abandoned building. One night, I woke up and I was back in that room, like physically, like I was frozen. I was stuck in this room.
Wow.
And where I was trying to make contact with the spirit. And I just remember, I can't wake up. I don't know how to get out of this. And I just heard a voice saying, is this what you want? And immediately I was like, I snapped myself back up to my body and I woke up. But just still trying to figure out how and why things like that happen. And even synchronicity. Mm-hmm. Synchronicity is like a huge part of my book.
Yeah.
You know, we're making more progress with quantum entanglement and these kinds of things. So just really paying attention to that, you know.
Yeah. I was
things maybe you would normally dismiss.
I was so thrilled just recently when the recent Nobel Prize went to the fellow, of course, the physicist who discovered that the universe is not emergent at all, and I think that was so important. It's such an important discovery, and it really lends to everything that we're talking about here. Is that, you know, this is something that we are all trying to understand and creating, you know, as we go. Yep. We're creating this, and, you know, we have so much internal power. And like, I completely relate to you when you say, you know, that this is just this ongoing unfolding journey of discovery, because that's exactly yep. how I think Mike and I have felt about this mm-hmm. too.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we started this heading in one direction, I thought, and my mind has been blown interview after interview. And I'm finding myself more interested in things and cracking myself open in ways that I had not been open to at all since starting this show. So it's pretty fantastic.
Yeah. Just setting your attention, just like you said, Morgan, you know, even, you know, if I'm needing something, if I'm struggling with something, you know, just setting that intention, whether it's to my creator, my spirit guides, whatever it is, can you show me in my dream, you know, something this evening that can help me? You know, for some reason, it's more like the naps I take. That dream time is a totally different place.
Yeah.
But those messages come, you know, you just have to be open to them.
Yeah, that yeah. is such a key. And we found, you know, within parapsychology and the studies that have been done time after time after time, whether it be through, you know, J.B. Ryan and or the Monroe Institute or you know, places like that, they've connected that over and over again, that this, you know, this unconscious connection when we're, you know, almost becomes more conscious, you know, as soon as we're sleeping, there's something that is we just let go of resistance and everything just begins to flow.
Yes.
It's so amazing. Okay. So I have a question before I let you go, because I'm going to ask you this and I really want your opinion on it. So this is kind of off the wall, but I thought about this earlier. So on the property that Terry Lynn and her husband have, and where we've been doing the Haunted Hollow workshops and stuff like that, we have a dog man, and he's been such a learning curve for me. I've never encountered anything like this ever. Yeah. Just phenomenal. And, you know, people, I've connected with people all over the world that have had, you know, encounters, and they say, oh, it's terrifying and it's all of these things. And Terry Lynn and I took a very, very different approach to him, because what we saw in him was, and in his behavior right from the early encounters, Terry Lynn's husband had an encounter that was, he was literally within patting distance of this critter, was sitting in the back of his truck. And we looked at his behavior, and we realized that so much of it was shyness, a little bit of curiosity, but something that was very, very cautious. And every time we go do a haunted hollow, we go out to the woods and we shower him with love and abundance.
I love that.
And every time that we've done this, and I'm sure this Saturday is going to be the same, we invite him to attend, and he does. And we've mm-hmm. had groups of 20 that have seen him, and he keeps his distance, but he's unmistakable. And, you know, I was just wondering what's your take on that? And if you would have any advice to give us, if any.
Well, I think you're doing the right thing. Definitely. This reminds me of, once during my dream time, I have etchings of this entity. I don't know what he was. Well, I came to find, I think I know what he was. But I kept seeing this man dressed in black, smoking a cigarette, kind of hiding his fire behind the smoke. Mm-hmm. I started seeing him at this Walmart by my house. And I knew, like, in my waking life, if I ever drove by this man, to kind of step on this gas.
Yeah.
You know, he was evil, he was devil, all of these things. So like 2 days later, I'm driving past a Walmart at night, and he's standing out there smoking on the corner. And I just did this double take. And even with all of my history, I'm telling, you know, I'm still questioning myself. Did I just see what I saw? So again, I just kind of like stepped on the gas. I got home, I did this whole smudging. And then that night he came back to me, approached me in my dream time. And the whole thing was about, he had a very important piece of advice to give me, but because I let fear kind of contaminate that experience, I wouldn't receive that message for like another 10 or so years. Mm. So again, it's about, you know, that fear factor.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even like the devil. He was just like an archetype. You know, these yeah. were, he was trying to tell me these were clothes that other people put on him, you know, and I was allowing my perception, you know, I was allowing others to kind of contaminate that perception of what the situation was. So again, bringing fear into this as much as you can, into this experience.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we've been so conscious of, because I think we're at the point now, and I mean, and Terry Lynn has seen him a couple of times, quite close, and I saw him quite close on a couple of occasions now, and that's the one thing I've been really conscious of is if I'm somewhere on the property by myself, I'm always kind of running through my head, okay, if he steps out onto this trail, I can't freak out. I've invited him here, and I've got, so now what I do is I go out to the tree line and whatnot. Even when I'm waiting for people to arrive, I'm usually the one that's sort of helping everybody get organized. And I go out and I just chat with them. And lo and behold, you'll be standing at the tree line and you hear crunch, 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 within 3 feet. And you look over there and there's no one there. You can't see them, but you sure as hell know he's standing there, and usually what we see are these two bright, bright, bright eyes. And they're like LED light eyes. And it's just been a phenomenal, phenomenal experience. But I'm glad to hear you say that, we're on the right track, we're doing the right thing.
The first thing that came to me, just the way my mind works, it goes all over the place. But my first thing would be to kind of drop to my knees, like with any animal, to show it that you're not a threat, but also as a sign of respect.
Ooh, that's really good.
So that was the first thing that I thought of.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I know we've been, we always make sure after the event, we go out and we thank him. And, thank you for, she always says, thank you for protecting the property. He seems to do his rounds on the property. Usually you see him in roughly the same places at night. And she and her husband have felt that, he seems to be doing his rounds and he leaves the dogs alone, but he's unfortunately, picked up a habit of going after neighbors' chickens. So
Has anyone ever tried to bring him like some food or some kind of offering?
We did,
KFC.
KFC.
I love it.
We brought him the first night. What did we take him the first night? We took him something, and then the second event that we did, we had a bunch of leftover really juicy cooked hot dogs, and we took him a plate of those, and there was quite a few left. And we said, we're here, we just wanted to thank you, hope you enjoy them and whatever, and they were long gone afterwards. So
that is amazing. That is absolutely amazing.
he's phenomenal. He's just been such a gift, because it's a learning curve, and we've got tracks, and I mean, it's really been something else. So this Saturday we're going back out again, but I digress. Chris, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Chris. Here's Morgan for this episode's segment of Spiritual Healthcare.
In this episode's edition of Spiritual Healthcare, the segment of the show where you get to be the creator and designer of your paranormal and spiritual experience, we are going to tell you about a process called the home base process. This process is best used when you have a stressful environment, but can also be used when you're feeling good as well. We all have days where we wish we could just hop on a plane and get out of here. Sometimes it's a city, a place of work, traffic, or sometimes your own home. Remember when you were little and you had those special moments of playtime and imagination? Some kids played house, some would fantasize about going into space, and others had fun imagining themselves in places like Disneyland. Often, as adults, we leave these escapes behind and think about them as being silly daydreams. Our parents teach us that they aren't real life, so there's just no point. However, as we grow older, these happy places might look different, but we usually still hold some version of them dear. When our environments are causing strain, find a quiet place and close your eyes. Imagine your perfect space. It can look like anything. It might be a place where you've been on vacation, or even a wonderful spot you've created with your own imagination. Think about the details. Look around the room in your mind. What's there? What does it feel like, look like, smell like? How does it feel to be there? This is a wonderful place you can return to again and again whenever you need a reprieve from what's going on around you. You can also come to this place to set new intentions for your life going forward. You need nothing to be happy, but you need something to be sad. Remember, at the end of seeking, all is consciousness. Stay in peace, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Supernatural Circumstances, a co-production of Entity Seeker Paranormal Research and Teachings and Good Egg Studios. This podcast is part of the Curious Cast podcast network. Theme music by Corey Johnson of Catalyst Records in Edmonton, Alberta. You can find out more about Morgan Knudsen at entityseeker.ca and more about me and listen to my other show at darkpoutine.com. Feel free to email the show at supernaturalcircumstances@gmail.com. Good night for now.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone.
Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.